A lot of
it. Guys almost run over him.
A lot of different kinds of whining. I mean, wine.
Good afternoon. Welcome to House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Monday, the 20th of May, and we're continuing our informational meetings as we await the opportunity to work the very few Senate bills that we have. So we're going to open an informational meeting on innovation in transportation infrastructure financing. We're joined today by four experts on various aspects of this question. So we have four chairs. I understand you guys have rehearsed. So DJ Vogt, Jeremy Rogers, John Carter, and Duncan Wise, please come forward and help us get started. We appreciate you being here on an otherwise pretty nice day, isn't it?
Thank you, Chair Reed. I'll kick things off here and have some brief remarks and then hand it over to my colleagues. But first off, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz, all members of the committee, we want to extend our true thanks for your efforts, your hard work on securing the funding for the I-5 replacement bridge. Excellent effort doing that early in the session, and our respective groups really want to express our thanks for that effort. That was a great job. I'm DJ Vogt. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Business Association. As many of you know, the OBA represents approximately 300 businesses across the state, ranging from Portland to Boardman, from sole proprietorships to Fortune 500 companies. These businesses share our vision for balanced policy solutions and contribution to the overall well-being of our state's economy. And turning to today's proceedings, at this point we recognize that the governor and the legislature have informed stakeholders in the transportation arena that they intend to pursue a funding package in 2015. This is the case for many reasons, primarily because of the declining gas tax revenues. This is due to increased fuel economy of vehicles and also the emergence of alternative fuel vehicles. With that, we face what we see as a threefold challenge. Number one, how do we make investments in the existing system with the traditional revenue sources? Another question, how do we encourage more innovative thinking and policy that maintains this user pay principle for funding transportation, but also identifies another mechanism to collect revenue? And third, how can we continue Oregon's record of innovative land use and transportation policies and transition to a more flexible transportation future? Now, we recognize that the stakeholder group on transportation has grown since the days of the OTIA investment, and we look forward to working with advocates from all different constituencies to answer these questions going forward. With that, I'm going to turn it to Jeremy Rogers, Project Manager for the Oregon Business Plan.
Thank you, DJ. Thank you, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Gorsuch and Benz. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm Jeremy Rogers. I work for the Oregon Business Council, and I'm the Project Manager for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort among many of the state's business leaders and business associations with the goal of creating 25,000 jobs a year in Oregon and raising Oregonians' personal income levels above the national average. And we appreciate the opportunity today to be before you to talk about ways we think that this committee can help do that and help continue to do that. The business plan has prioritized transportation investments from day one, and we want to thank you for your leadership, not only this session with the Columbia River or the Columbia River Crossing project, but the OTIA investments, the Connect Oregon program, the Jobs and Transportation Act. It's been a series of very responsible investments made in Oregon over the last decade since the business plan was launched in 2002, and we've been excited to partner with you on that and to continue that partnership. One of the reasons why we support the transportation investments because these investments help strengthen Oregon's export economy. And whether we're talking about shipping logs from eastern Oregon to global markets, Dungeness crab from the Oregon coast to markets in Asia, Intel chips from Washington County to PCs all over the world, we are an export-based economy and need to continue these investments to maintain our competitiveness. We support these investments because they open and facilitate access to industrial lands, connect employees to their places of work, and provide Oregonians and Oregon businesses with a variety of choices about how to move themselves, their families, and their goods to market. So we strongly support continuing the strong investments that have been made over the past decade. And we also believe that in order to do that, we're going to need to be national leaders in finding innovative ways to finance our transportation system. And as DJ said, we're very supportive and looking forward to working with you and all the stakeholders, both on an investment package in 2015, as well as kind of the long-term solutions to transportation financing in Oregon. And fortunately, today we have two experts with us that I think that you'll really enjoy hearing from and hopefully enjoy asking questions to and interacting with, because they have a lot of expertise in this topic. And so I'll turn it over to Duncan Wise, President of the Oregon Business Council, and later hear from John Carter, Chairman of Schnitzer Steel Industries, and they'll talk about some of their ideas on moving forward, how we can finance the transportation system. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. I really thank you for the opportunity to be before you. As I understand the assignment, we're to be suggesting ideas for you to think about in the future, for future legislative sessions, ideas that may take a little time to generate, you know, the details of the idea. And for me, this is like a dream come true, the idea that I can throw out big ideas and not have any responsibility for figuring out how to do it. I just, this is a, you know, an opportunity that I really appreciate. So I'm thrilled.
We may have to interrupt occasionally with questions
and
reactions.
But in all seriousness, the Oregon Business Plan, which John is the chair of, as well as the chair of Schnitzer Steel, we use that as a tool for focusing on a few big policy issues that we can work on together. And so this opportunity to work with you is really an important one, because if you signal to us areas of interest, then that gives us time during the interim to do some of the policy work and research that might help you as you move forward and build the coalitions to make something big happen. So we are going to throw out some ideas today. If there are any that pique your interest, let us know, and that'll be a signal to us to go to work. Before I get into the transportation issue, I would like to just highlight the Oregon Business Plan website as a resource for you. I hope many of you have looked at it, but if you haven't, just to remind you what the business plan is. As Jeremy mentioned, it is an economic strategy about how to create jobs and grow incomes and reduce poverty in Oregon. The plan itself is a collaboration among a variety of interests, and we really appreciate the partnership. On the website, you can get information about the major industry clusters in the state and their needs. We have, through our industry cluster network, a pretty well-documented set of opportunities for each of the major industry clusters. And we have, on the initiative page, we have all the current initiatives that we've brought forth in the Oregon Business Plan around the four P's for prosperity: people, place, productivity, and pioneering innovation. We have the current initiatives and the current recommendations. But on the sidebar here, you can get a lot of background and research on a whole variety of topics that we aren't necessarily bringing forth in the current period, but give you some background. So, for example, on transportation, we have a whole section on transportation that gives you the broader vision for transportation. It also goes through a lot of the history of what we've done and what you have done over the last decade or so. So, anyway, it's a good background resource. We have a lot of policy papers in here, so feel free to use that. And just wanted you to be aware of that if you want to research any of the policy issues associated with the business plan. So, with that, let me talk transportation. I'll throw out, I'm going to give you one big idea today, the Transportation Utility Commission. John Carter, I'm sure, will have more than one. Knowing John, he's got a fertile imagination in mind. But let's talk about transportation. The first thing we know about transportation is what DJ has already pointed out. We need more money in the system. It's clearly underfunded. At the federal level, we were just back in Washington last week, the trust fund is going to zero in the next 12 months or so. It's the only reason there's money out of the federal formula is because they put general fund into it. It's absolutely going to zero. At the state level, as DJ pointed out, we rely on the gas tax. The gas tax is less and less effective. It's not keeping up with inflation. It's not keeping up with fuel economy in improved mileage. And as a source, it's vulnerable in the long run, especially as we move to new vehicle types, whether it's natural gas or electricity or whatever. At the local level, the property tax system has been the main source of transportation funding historically. After Measure 5, increasingly the money that was going to transportation went to police and fire. As Representative Nathanson knows, being on the city council, there was a real tough set of decisions. And so that is I would argue as a source for local funding, it is less and less viable going forward. So we've got a real problem with the revenue sources and a growing need. As we look at ODOT's numbers, and I'm sure you're aware, the dollars for new projects after maintenance preservation are covered, there are very few dollars available as you look out into the next decade or so. So you got a problem as we build the bridge and look at other projects. And so we have a revenue problem that we know about. We had that issue in front of us with the OTIA package 4 years ago, and as part of that work, we did recommend, and you adopted, an increase in the gas tax. But also as part of that, we did take a pretty big and bold look at the structure of the transportation system as a whole, and took a look at it in light of modern times, recognizing that this transportation system that we have was basically invented about 100 years ago. The gas tax is nearly 100 years old. I've always dreamed we were the first state on the gas tax. We could be the first state off the gas tax. The transportation delivery system probably made a lot of sense, dividing cities from counties to states at the time. But now, of course, all of you know that those systems are all intertwined in ways that, I can't tell you what a county road from a city road from a state road is anymore. They're all basically woven together with no real coherence. So we have, as we see it, three big problems as we look at this system, if you want to call it that. First of all, as a system, there is no regular assessment of the revenue needs of the system. And you basically what you see from time to time are studies, and they're not necessarily presented in any consistent way of the city needs, the county needs, the state needs, and they're not organized with the major accounts that you would expect in a normal, say, utility function. You don't have the depreciation, for example, is not considered as part of the equation. And again, there's no consistent way to evaluate the revenue needs of the system. The second problem with the way we have it today is that there is no systematic review of the efficiency of the system. You have multiple jurisdictions. You have multiple maintenance. I don't know how many maintenance operations we have overseeing this system. And there's no inquiry-based model to investigate whether there are better ways of delivering the system. The third problem is that the revenue system itself is obsolete, as I mentioned earlier. The gas tax and the property taxes are not the right revenue source for the system going forward for the reasons we've already discussed. Other than that, it's a great system. But these are fundamental problems of design. And what we would point out is, in Oregon, we have been known at periods of time, and I think we're in one of these periods right now, where we reinvented our systems. Last session, you reinvented the education and the healthcare systems. We're now beginning to see the fruits of that. I would argue, as you look forward, this might be the time to reinvent the transportation system and how we deliver and think about the services. And what would that new system design look like? What we came up with in the OTIA period was that we could think about the transportation system much like you think of any other utility. Really, that's what it is. It's like, think of a gas transmission system or an electric utility system. This is a utility. Conceptually, we've asked road users, for those users to pay for that system. That's a model we're all pretty familiar with. In other areas, this system though is so different from what you might experience if you were, for example, dealing with an electric utility. Imagine that the electric utility, rather than going to the Public Utilities Commission, came to you every so often and said, "We need an electric rate increase, and we don't really have particularly good data on why we need it, but we need it." And you know we need it, and you may say, well, you may need it, but this really isn't a very good time for electric rate increase, so we can't do it. And then you just keep going back and forth, and we might go on for years like that. And what do you think might happen to that utility infrastructure? It's likely to decline in as they fail to maintain it, and very likely to become a much more expensive system as you have a lot of deferred maintenance build up. That's really what we've got in the transportation system. You have a multi-billion dollar asset that you are responsible for without any systematic way of protecting that asset and making sure that it's maintained properly and make sure that you've got a rate structure to continue it on in a systematic way. So what would a Transportation Utility Commission do? It would do many of the things that your Public Utility Commission in the electric and natural gas area does today. It would come up with a systematic book of accounts for all the utilities in Oregon, city, county, state. It would come up with a total revenue need that you could allocate for the system. You would have, if you will, rate cases, that's what we call them in the utility field, and there would be a careful assessment of the needs. You would look for efficiency improvements as part of that. If there were multiple maintenance systems, you would point that out and you might demand changes in the system. And you would look at a rate design that equitably and fairly paid for that system, probably looking at things like vehicle miles traveled as a different model or potentially time of use. But you'd look at the whole range of rate options and figure out what the rates ought to be. You would, in essence, have a systematic way of thinking about the needs and how you're going to pay for the transportation infrastructure that we so badly need to carry commerce, as Jeremy pointed out. So it's a big idea, simple idea, really. Good bill should pass. Let's just get it done. but again, I bring it to you because I hope it sheds light. You are dealing with an incredibly important asset in our state. And for as long as I've been here, it's an asset that, frankly, we haven't been taking very good care of. I don't know about you, but I have potholes all over my neighborhood, and there are a lot of unmet needs. And I don't think we can blame any particular session of the legislature or any city council, but I would argue this isn't a problem of any particular decision you've made. It is a systems problem. And when you have a systems problem, you need to fix the system. I don't know if this is the right answer. I think it's a pretty good one, but you may come up with a better one. But an inquiry, between now and the next legislative session about what you want to do, what a good system for delivering transportation, would be an inquiry that could have huge benefits, not just in 2015 and 17, but for the next 50 years. Because remember, this is a system that's 100 years old, and it's way past due for redesign. So with that, I'll turn it to John. John Carter, just so you know, before he was at Schnitzer, was at Bechtel Corporation for some 33 years, something like that. I think Bechtel in that time probably has built more infrastructure than, we were just talking, probably about $1 trillion of infrastructure. So he's got a little experience. But I want him to have the lion's share of the time and conversation with you. So,
thank you very much. Mr. Carter, we appreciate you spending time with us today.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairs and members, thank you. My name is John Douglas Carter. My advanced staff here has overblown my importance to these proceedings, but I do want to say that you all have my admiration for taking the time to actually think about a problem that needs a lot of thought. And yeah, that's unfortunately unusual in today's world, and I want to extend my personal thanks to you for doing that. I am chair of the Oregon Business Plan at present. I'm chairman of Schnitzer Steel, chairman of Cooney Automotive, and I'm on the board at Fluid Systems, Gerald Wynn, and Northwest Natural Gas. My history is not in the state, because although I was born and raised here, most of my business career was outside of the state. But I am here today because I love the state, as you all do, and because anything that we can do to help the state in a very competitive modern world is a substantial plus for all of us. It's interesting because, as Duncan said, and I know you all more than appreciate, the problem in infrastructure, and particularly in transportation infrastructure, is a lack of funds. I've often said our parents' generation built a system of infrastructure that had a great deal of margin in it, and our generation managed to use it up without replacing it. And we owe that replacement of that margin for our children and grandchildren. But to replace that margin, times have changed, money demands have changed, and as Duncan says, the system has not responded to those changes in the same way that we may have been able to do so in other areas. The irony is there's a lot of money available. It just doesn't happen to be in the public sector. Transportation infrastructure investment, as is the case with most infrastructure investment, is very attractive in today's environment. The reason it's very attractive is because there's a lot of money that is in pools around the world that have different characteristics that's looking for a home. And at the moment, most of that money is sitting in temporary homes. And you see very odd things happen, like private equity firms investing in hydroelectric dams in Africa. Blackstone announced a couple of weeks ago that they were in the process of doing that. You see things like insurance companies, for example, who are the classic example of long-term money that need to have a particular life insurance companies and those that write annuities and the like need to have an assurance of reliable returns over the long term so they can plan their own financial status. And you see the modern invention, I guess, of what sometimes we call hot money, but otherwise we would call people sitting on the sidelines looking for a good opportunity to invest that have parked their money in money market funds and bonds, which are basically negative yield at this point, all trying to find a way to put that money to more productive work. And then lastly, you see imbalance in our national trade accounts. And one of the classic issues there is that the Chinese, of course, have huge amounts of foreign exchange, that the only rational way of putting those back to use is to reinvest in the companies that they have dramatic net surpluses with, and that includes us. So the opportunity to attract that money does exist. What we don't have is we don't have, as again Duncan said, we don't have a system that is reliable, predictable, and able to actually create an environment where that money can feel comfortable investing. And we don't have a vehicle to translate how that money becomes invested in infrastructure. But the reality is we actually have a number of examples. We have those examples on the domestic front, and we have them on the international front. Most of my career at Bechtel involved some of the things that we did that were actually very interesting, a lot of fun to do. It's a nice thing about being a large private company is that you can choose the things you like to work on. And many of the things that we did involved public-private partnerships. I'm not sure how many of you know that if you rode the Eurostar from London to Paris, you were riding on one of our trains. If you went to the Summer Olympics, you were on a property that belonged to London Continental Railways, a company of which we had the majority share that built the Channel Tunnel Rail Link. If you've been in Asia, there are a number of different places there where we did public-private partnerships, Shenzhen Toll Road, Meizhuang, which was the first public-private power plant in China. And I could go on, but the point isn't really a listing of those things. The point is that there are lots of different examples of how the private sector and the public sector have worked together to bring funds that the public sector needed to do things that had a public benefit, but were also financeable without detriment to the public fisc. We actually have a local example. One of the examples here is, of course, the light rail project to the airport, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But is a really good example of one where the private sector provided both the certainty in terms of performance of the construction contract on price and schedule, but also provided the funding in return for the opportunity to develop property that was owned by the Port of Portland. And consequently, you have today the light rail to the airport, which I am rather proud of because it's one of the very few in the world that goes actually into the air terminal, which actually makes it usable, as opposed to most of the other ones, which stop just enough short that you can't carry your luggage and you have to have somebody else transfer to a different system. And it is, and it resulted in the development of Cascade Station. So these things are quite possible. And I think that the difficulty is recreating the way we think about infrastructure. Most of the opposition to public-private partnerships comes in the form, one way or another, of saying, well, why do we have to pay for it? You know, do we have to pay a toll, or we have to pay a user charge, or we have to do something else? And as a proud independent Oregonian, I certainly agree 100% with that. On the other hand, we've kind of chipped away at that over the years, and if we go back to our history, you'll realize that there are a lot of cities and towns in the state called Tollgate, Taylor's Ferry, Patterson Ferry. Those were not things that were made up. Those were places where you paid tolls. And that is, in fact, the history of how things got done before we figured out how to use the automobile as the basis for funding and transportation infrastructure. We may have reached that point again where Back to the Future might be the right result in terms of how we look at transportation funding. And the other element that is important to realize is that we have, because of technology, dramatically different means in terms of adjusting how we do user fees so that they fall in the areas where we feel the users have the most benefit, not simply because they show up or time or they happen to pass a toll spot. And I would also say that having the private sector involved is probably a much needed efficiency move at this point, since the toll systems on the East Coast, none of which I would emulate, by the way, have fallen into a state of disrepair as well. I mean, I'm sure some of you are familiar with the Massachusetts study about 5 years ago, where they concluded if they closed the toll system down, they'd save the state money. That's probably not where we want to go. But having said that, the challenge for this group is how do we figure out a way to pick the projects that we want, finance those projects in a way that is able to essentially free up state debt capacity for doing other things, because otherwise we would have to provide that capacity for transportation infrastructure, and get a product that we have both political support and public acceptance of. And my belief is that's very doable. I mean, I think that that's something that I would welcome, and I know a lot of other people in the private sector would welcome opportunities to help develop. We do appreciate the work that this committee did on the Interstate Bridge. Some of you may recall a proposal that actually I tabled about 13 years ago to do that as a public-private project. And at the time, one of the things I said was that we could do it this way and hope we get the support for it, and we had a lot of support at federal level on a substantial earmark, or we can spend the next decade paying consultants. Now, I'd leave it up to you as to which choice we made. So, I have I didn't have any particular prepared remarks because my impression of this was that people really wanted to have a dialogue and ask questions, and I'm all yours.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Representative Lively?
So I find this all pretty fascinating, but so I'm going to go back, though. Part of it, from my standpoint, is what drives the cost, and part of that is design or standards in that. And I'm wondering if that shouldn't be part of the conversation, because if I think about this state, and I travel a lot around the state, I see a lot of very fine highways that carry very little traffic, and we've invested a lot in that infrastructure. And not to suggest we shouldn't have, mm-hmm. but I'm going to go back to kind of the designs. And if I go to different cities in that, whether we have sidewalks or we don't have sidewalks, the width of streets. So to me, as we talk about the need for funding, it seems to me part of that discussion to be the need for what the type of infrastructure even is and whether the models we've been using are the correct models, especially going forward if we're going to change to some extent our transportation modes.
Well, I think that's a very good observation. I know Duncan agrees because I can see him nodding. It's interesting. That cuts both ways. When the California Department of Highways, now with its new modern name of Caltrans, ruled the West Coast in the 1960s, they created a system of standard specifications. Those standard specifications, despite several efforts over the years, have never been updated. Components of them have been, you know, bits and pieces, but a comprehensive review hasn't been. So I can't give you the history on Oregon standard specs, but I suspect that there's a correlation, and don't underestimate the effort necessary to do that and the cost and time involved. But I think the end result is absolutely correct, which is that what was designed to do something that basically grew out of the interstate system is not necessarily the optimum design for application in the current environment. And that is also part of the structure of the way that we contract for, I'll just take roads for a minute. Now, you realize, of course, that I am a product of the private sector, and so I do have certain biases, but I am absolutely convinced that in transportation infrastructure that you can't possibly design a project more expensively than doing it by the government contracting method. So the reality is the only way to deal with that is to change to, instead of design specs, performance specs. And I'm sure many of you are very familiar with that. But your performance specs then take into account the application that you're trying to address in terms of movement of traffic and weight limits, speed limits, and all the rest of those things, in order to say it's feasible from an economic standpoint to create this project, whereas it may not be if we went on the basis of what are classic standard specs for our highways. So I agree with that. I think there's an enormous desire from various interest groups, whether it's truckers or private drivers or public transit people, that every time you do something, that every ornament on the Christmas tree has to be involved. And frankly, the trees just aren't strong enough to bear all those ornaments these days, and you got to have some different way of doing it.
Sure, and I appreciate that. And having spent my life working in the private sector, I have some bias to that too. But so let's take that a little bit further. So if we turn this project over, and it's a private, and so we have a performance-based system in that and do the project. So if the system fails, if something happens, who's liable, or where does the responsibility end up back in that situation?
Well, again, I think this comes back. There's three or four different ways of addressing that. First, I've always found it interesting. Again, you know, Bechtel's a rather large company. Our turnover was about $40 billion a year. And you know, our resources in terms of being able to back something in a company like that were adequate.
Sure.
I mean, we could provide our own insurance, our own performance guarantees and the like. And that's just not true with everybody out there that's doing work, and you don't want to confine your work to a very few large organizations, nor, frankly, would large organizations generally want to do most of the things that you want if you get done. But one of the things to look at is how the conception, design, construction, and operation and maintenance cycle works. And it's actually the coordination and integration of that cycle that is the secret to the design-build companies like Bechtel. That's why they make money. It's also the secret to being able to get performance guarantee insurance, or efficacy insurance, as we called it. I actually was a part of creating that market 20 years ago because it didn't exist and we needed it. And it's something that is available and can be done as long as you can provide a project that's structured so that the providers of that risk insurance understand that there is a high likelihood you're going to get from A to C. The difficulty of most public-private partnership examples is everybody starts out with great ideas and wonderful intent, but there's not a map. And so what happens is you get bogged down in the middle with trying to get through the process, whatever the process happens to be at the time. And we don't, you know, I mean, I freely admit I have a point of view on this, but the agencies that are involved in approval and oversight of projects that are transportation type all have different points of view and motivations, and we don't measure any of them on the basis of outcome. You know, I joke about this, but I always thought that a permitting agency's job was to issue permits, but I found out a long time ago that probably isn't the case. So if you're going to try and do something like this, you have to look at that system. You have to look at the design, build, and maintain and operate system, but you also have to look at the system that it flows through. And you have to say, we're willing to give certain levels of priority to transportation projects, which is the topic today, but infrastructure projects in general, that we think have an overriding greater good. And the legislature is perfectly capable of doing that. They do it all the time. They just do it in areas that are that haven't been focused on transportation recently.
I'm intrigued by the description of the Transportation Utility Commission and by the concepts around public-private partnerships. I've had a very primitive kind of exposure to some of those things. I wonder if you, in your various experiences and perspectives, could help us kind of do a very quick survey of other entities that made that transition well and those that didn't. There's obviously a difference between policy and politics and how we might or might not do that. As we're thinking about what what this committee might do in the interim and into the next legislative session, are there particular lessons you'd draw from your experience?
Well, Mr. Chair, as far as when we looked at this back in 2008-09, as far as we could tell, no one had ever applied this model to transportation. So I don't think if you were to do this, it would be new, just the nature of it. But as far as the model goes, I mean, again, all you have to do is talk to your friends at the Public Utilities Commission. This is a very, I would confess, I spent 7 years at a utility commission. I'm very familiar with how it works. It's a very well-known process. And again, I would argue that my own experience is that there is such similarity between what goes on in an electric utility or gas utility and a transportation infrastructure. They're very, very similar processes. So if you are interested in pursuing this, there are obviously some differences, and I think Representative Lively hit one. I think there is a real question of the specific the design, what you're trying to build. It's obviously true in transmission lines as well, but I mean, I think there's probably more policy content and the decisions on sidewalks and setbacks and all that than there might be in other areas. So there are certainly some differences. But if this were something you were to pursue, I think we'd have to start. And as any great, the first step of a redesign is to get the basic architectural drawings in place, and then there would be a lot of detailed work that would have to be done. And again, my own experience with redesign is what you all would need to do is give a bipartisan direction that you're interested in this. You would need to get a smart group of people to actually bring ideas out. You'd need to have them talk to stakeholders and make sure that all the, you know, considerations were put. But you would need to oversee a process where you ask people like John Carter and other people I could imagine who would actually do some really thoughtful design work for you. The key to it, though, ultimately, is having policy leaders with an interest and a willingness to work across partisan lines and really do some significant work. Because if this became a, you know, anything other than that, it would quickly fall apart. You're talking about a lot of jurisdictions, a lot of different issues. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if that's helpful, but I mean, I think the process starts with an agreement that you're trying to do something different and you have a broad design in mind, and then have people go off and play with that design and bring back issues. Exactly the kind of thing Representative Lively just raised. I mean, there are a lot of issues you'd have to work through. But again, it would, in a series of, you know, sessions, and I think over a few months, you could actually come up with a pretty exciting design.
It's interesting because I think the utility example is a good one. My memory is a little dim on this, but when I was in high school in Pendleton, Oregon, the state of Oregon had about 145 independent telephone utilities. Mm-hmm. And obviously that transition went from there to where we are today. And I don't know anything about how many power utilities and the like were existing then as well. But so it's not impossible to do. It just takes that time and planning and building the recognition that it's a better way of getting to a long-term result. On the public-private partnership side, there are a lot of examples of that. I wish there were more. But it's the structures can all be different. The structures can be, for example, one of the classic things is, well, we don't want to turn over assets to the private sector. Well, you don't have to. I mean, a lot of things are structured on the basis of a term, and you've got a value of an income stream that has a net present value that you can finance under net term. I mean, when we, for example, when we privatized the underground in the UK, we did that on the basis of a long-term lease. The first private power plant in Mexico was done on the basis of a long-term lease. We didn't have a leasing company at the time, so I went to Gary Went, who had a GE cap, and we used their vehicle that they do their washing machine leases with, because we had to have a history of leasing. But you can come up with solutions to these problems as long as you have people who really are trying to achieve a goal. But you got to have consensus on the goal. If you don't have consensus on the goal, then there's just too many pitfalls along the way that can get you off course. California's had a public-private partnership program for a number of years. We did this at SR-91, SR-125, and it was kind of an interesting contrast. The SR-91, which is, many of you may have gone to John Wayne International Airport on, was basically privatization of a toll lane. That's it. It wasn't privatization of the highway, it was just a toll lane. There's been examples of similar things in Texas. Again, the UK did a really interesting number of things in this area, which, you know, people look back and say, well, it's Maggie Thatcher and a conservative government. Actually, most of the things that I was involved in with the rail system there were under the Blair government. And so it's not a conservative, liberal, it isn't a partisan kind of thing. It's, you know, what's the best way to find a solution to a problem that we all share? And there are lots of examples, you know, for example, in the Manila water system. That's a public-private partnership. Bechtel operates half of the city and the French operate the other half. We've actually been doing pretty well. They've had their problems. We took the poor half of town because we thought people would be much more amenable to getting a better system, and they took the rich half of town and found people didn't want to pay the rates. So there's just examples all over the world. Not all of them will apply here, but what's interesting about it is that you've got so many different pieces that you can mix and match to come up with something that fits what you're trying to do.
Thank you. Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Wise, you made a comment about a 100-year-old system that needs to be, I guess, needs to be updated. And I was just sitting here thinking, you have, because we're talking about a big system, we got a lot of issues that we can, a few questions I got to
sure.
really get my mind spinning here. Do you have any idea of other places? And we're hearing about not one system fits all the opportunities. Is there somebody out there that's doing it better? And I guess the question we have up here is, what is it that we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
What's the outcome here? I mean,
right.
we already heard from, is it safety? Is it sidewalks?
Yep.
Is it moving people? I mean, there's all kinds of things. So is there somebody who's set up a system, a model, a measure? And
That's a great question, Representative Cameron. I would probably not look to the United States exclusively. First of all, to what we're trying to accomplish. To me, what I think you want to accomplish is a system where you have smooth roads, well-maintained, you're taking care of your basic assets. I don't see that in Oregon right now, frankly. I see a lot of potholes. So you've got a very, a large infrastructure you want to take care of, that you want to build new infrastructure that's appropriate to the demand, that's cost-effective.
Of course, we're going to be broader than just roads, too, thinking about
sure.
some of the other people
yeah,
in the room.
Yeah, very, very important point. I'm thinking roads right now, yeah. but, I mean, there are other... I'm
thinking just, my scooter? Or,
the transit side
vehicle.
Of it. Yeah. And we need a way, which gets me to the point, we need a way of allowing alternatives to the automobile to be competitive in an environment as an alternative building more roads and highways. My suggestion would be you're probably going to have a system that is paid for by usage and probably by time of use, because one of the great inefficiencies of the American system we've learned looking at places that apply time of use pricing is that if you apply time of use pricing, people make choices and they use it less during peaks, and it's a much cheaper and arguably better, quicker way to deal with congestion. And so congestion pricing is likely to be part of that. So what you need is a system where you have an efficient way of pricing, like more market-based pricing, if you will, that charges as in any market. When you've got peak demand, you tend to raise your price. That helps provide signals about when you want to build more facilities or look at alternatives like transit, and a system that generates enough revenue to pay for both the fixed system that you have, but also to build the new systems that you need. And that's generally what you'd want. And I'd say in Europe, where we've seen different pricing models in Stockholm and London and other places, they've seen a lot of productivity, a lot of improvement in their transportation systems.
So follow up, maybe Mr. Carter, you want to say something?
If I could just add a comment to that, because I think it would be remiss not to point out that all things are not equal. I mean, you've got to do the things that generate jobs and move the economy. So it has to be about freight mobility, along with all these other things that are nice to have.
Yes.
And that, I think, is something that sometimes gets lost in a conversation.
Agreed, totally.
Duncan, you mentioned about usage and time and pain, and as a hamburger flipper, I know during lunchtime I want to get as many people through the doors and I can mm-hmm. adjust the price, and I get that concept. But the difference is we're dealing with board of directors 60 and 90 and 91 or whatever, and yet we have bureaucracies here on their busiest day of the week, they shut their doors. So how do you deal with a system that shuts its doors when they have the most people in their building because they have no competition? And that's what I'm sitting here going. I mean, we're going to hear and talk about this, and how do you get around it? It's different than private industry, and I guess maybe that's a big discussion.
And Representative Cameron, we've had this discussion before. I think the other element to your question is the notion that that the system you point to is part of a larger system that we could probably agree isn't putting its resources necessarily in all the right places. So I'd not to push back much on your point, but I think it exists in the context of a variety of other challenges.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, Mr. Cameron, I'm not here to redesign the person, that would be another conversation for me. But in terms of the transportation,
can you help me with that?
That's another. we are here to help. And again, if there are areas of inquiry, that's actually the point. There are lots of things you could be looking at.
They happen to be underneath the Department of Transportation.
But I'll just use the analogy of your restaurant. There are happy hours. And why do we have lower prices during happy hours? Because that's people are not in the restaurant, and so we have a different pricing, you know, regime under those periods. That's something. I'm not saying it's the only thing, but that needs to be considered about when you think about an efficient way of pricing the transportation system.
I'm thinking about happy hour on the Sunset Highway.
Happy hour on the Sunset Highway. It's 3 a.m.
Right. 3 a.m.
It's empty. So anyway, that's the point is, and again, all these are elements, and again, you don't have to buy all of the idea of a public utility model, but I think there are a lot of design questions about the current system that deserve review, that if you were in a systematic way, I think you could find different ways of organizing and delivering a system.
Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Thanks. So I've kind of been sitting here listening, and you know, money certainly is a challenge in terms of doing projects. Can you identify, though, some of the other hurdles besides money? Let's assume, and I've had this conversation in a different context, in a different committee. You know, Dr. Goldberg and I don't necessarily sometimes see eye to eye in healthcare, but we've got kind of come to a good understanding of even if you had all the money you wanted to do healthcare, there are other hurdles. You don't have enough providers. You don't have enough education programs, getting those providers into the pipeline. So I'm curious in your mind what some of those other hurdles besides money are, because you know, you mentioned Texas, and I was in Texas a few months ago, snuck out, you know, on a weekend and got down there, and I'll tell you, the sheer amount of construction down there makes, you know, the CRC look like bridges of Madison County. So and just vastly different in terms of the kind of ethics, probably not the right word, but you know, just the mindset of the people down there to go in and do, and what are the other hurdles that are keeping us from doing what we need to do here that aren't money related?
Oh, thanks. Well, this is well above my pay grade, but I think that what Duncan said about process and about having an overarching coordination function applies pretty much to everything we do in transportation in the state. The difficulty, Oregon is a fairly unique place in that it's sort of open season on any project until people get tired of talking about it. And that's really not the norm. The normal process is that there's a chance for everybody to voice whatever views they have on a project, whether they're pro or con or alternatives. And at the conclusion of that process, a decision is made to proceed with whatever modifications are made that come out of the process. But there's an end date to the process. And access to the challenge here in both the court and administrative system is unusually open. So as a result, you tend to find the administrators in the regulatory agencies are rightly very concerned that they not be criticized for cutting off access that is otherwise available through the process for anybody to say anything, and we have a state full of people who are perfectly happy to take advantage of that. And consequently, and I mean that, I'm trying to be as dispassionate as I can about it because it's a process issue, it's not a political issue necessarily. But at the end date, what it means is people just don't want to take that on. I mean, it's a problem we have for, just to talk about the business plan for a minute, it's a problem we have in terms of getting companies to relocate to the state because it's very difficult to give them any kind of assurances that they can actually do that within a time frame that fits the business cycle. So if you're talking about financing projects, particularly bringing in the private sector on financing, there's got to be a time frame in which those funds can be committed. And that time frame is essential to the process. And right now, that time frame in Oregon's a little frayed.
Can I follow up?
Please.
So given what you just said, I guess, and somewhere that culture kind of evolved over time, you know, how do you ratchet that back? Does that come from this body? Does it come from the executive branch? I mean, where do you start to make those adjustments Is it policy? Is it philosophical? I guess I'm just kind of curious how to spin that back around when I look at other states who are getting this done, and we seem to just kind of have potholes.
Well, I think it's leadership. I mean, I think basically what you've seen, believe me, a great deal of my life, I have not been mistaken for a Democrat. But I think the governor has done a very good job of leadership. You can disagree with some of the outcomes that he's trying to achieve, but I think he's done a pretty good job of making it clear where he wants to go and laying out a path to get there. I think that's been the power of the Oregon business plan from our perspective, is that we've made very clear the things that we want to achieve, and consequently we're more likely to be able to achieve them. And I think you folks here have a real potential and opportunity to provide some of that leadership in the transportation area, because you're doing what you're doing today. You know, you're thinking about it, you're looking at different ways to approach the problem, and if you articulate those in an attractive way to people in the state who realize, so, I mean, most people realize we've got to do something. I mean, nobody, just take the bridge for example. I mean, nobody's particularly interested in watching those pine logs that are the base structure for the older part of the bridge dissolve under them and put a bunch of people in the river or keep the lift band from operating. It's not that they want that result. It's how do they get a different result. And the only way you get a different result is to provide leadership to show how you get there. And I think you guys collectively are one major part of that. Duncan probably knows more about this than I do.
That was a great answer. I mean, up and down. I don't want to be the only one asking questions here. Representative Leibold.
So I just want to follow up a little bit on that, and I could discuss this for a long time. This is something that I'm really interested in and fascinated, and I think it deserves a lot more attention. But I'm going to go back to some of what you said, Mr. Carter, because I believe leadership is a key part of this. But given the partners or the how this crosses, so we have local governments and we have counties, I mean, we have a lot of partners. Before we get very far into this conversation, we're going to have to decide how we engage all those partners to build trust. Because one of the real problems right now with doing any of these things is trust. And it may be distrust of the private sector because they're going to make profits or something, or it may be distrust of the public sector because we've given too much away. I mean, there's this whole distrust thing. And so while I think this deserves a lot of conversation, that how we structure that conversation, and to some extent this is contrary, I understand your frustration how long this takes, but how we structure that when we start, regardless of the leaders involved, is going to have a big impact on whether we're successful with having that, because this crosses, and I think it should cross, all those particular lines. But if we start down this path, we collectively, and people don't trust that the process is, that we're having the open and honest dialogue in those things, it won't make any difference what the recommendation is then, because we're going to have the same issues you just described elongated. We're going to have court cases. We're going to have people interceding themselves in different things. So for me, it's an important conversation to have, but we got to make sure we truly engage all those partners when we're having that conversation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, this is a key point I want to make about any process for major change. The Oregon way of redesigning a system, and I've seen this in so many fields, is you bring all the stakeholders in a room who have a huge interest in the outcome,
right,
and tell them to redesign the system. And guess what happens? Mm-hmm. You'll get back in 6 to 10 months an idea that, you know, we could move this maintenance shop from this city over to this county and move 3 or 4 people around, and that would be a great thing. Please pass the bill.
That's right.
You will not get systemic change if you ask the current participants to redesign the system. There is a much better process to do this work that it does involve everybody, but in different ways. The structure I would recommend is that you, as a committee or the legislature, whatever the leadership group is, set out some specs for what you'd like to see. And again, I can imagine what those would be.
Performance specifications.
And put a team together to respond to that. The team should be dispassionate, disinterested, and then create a stakeholder group that has all kinds of opportunity to give voice to that process and to give you voice. But if you want to redesign a system, you've got to get a few people in a room to do the design work for you. And you can
kill it anytime you want, but if you ask the stakeholders, which is the Oregon way, to redesign their systems, you will get what you've got today. So that is that's a pretty simplistic answer, but it's, again, when I've seen really good systems redesign in Oregon, that's what's happened. And it's after a long and painful experience in other models. So, again, I think there's an opportunity. But the first step for you all would be to come together and say, yeah, we've got a problem in transportation. There's things that we really don't think we're working well. Define that, give some direction to a group. To say, okay, let's go research and come up with design ideas. And then you would need to be actively engaged in responding to those ideas.
Mr. Carter?
I'm reminded of the old joke about a horse designed by committee. It looks a lot like a camel, but the reality is that people, you can do it. I mean, people are trying to do it today. I mean, we're working on something in the Portland regional area, the metropolitan area, community investment initiative, which has some features of what we're talking about here today. We're trying to put together an infrastructure financing vehicle to help with that. And we're doing it really under the auspices of probably the least trusted group in the entire area, which is Metro. And as a result, you know, we're learning a lot. Metro's learned a lot, and we're making progress. Whether we actually get to the objective or not, I think, is still an open question, because at the same time, there are other efforts that I'm sure you're familiar with here, and the Treasurer and others are doing things, looking for different ways to finance things. And it may be a victim of success elsewhere, but nonetheless, it's been very illustrative, and it has had those features of, you know, we started out with the idea of, okay, let's figure out what we want to do, which is what Duncan is talking about, and then let's get everybody involved in how to help make it happen rather than take it off in a different direction.
Representative Cameron?
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Mr. Wise for excluding me from being a part of that group, because he said they had to be dispassionate.
The line I always
I cannot be appointed to any group.
Ever?
Oh, I think
not about this.
Okay. All right.
Choice of words.
No, it's good. It's good. And I always remember the line about how easy it is to marshal armies to defend the status quo. Exactly. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for being here today and for all your work on this and other issues. I noticed when we were working on the bridge project that the biggest challenge was in convincing the folks across Oregon that we actually needed it. And the message, that is, controlling the message from this vantage point is very difficult. And it seems that we're a victim almost of how good many of our roads are. And that is the case in my district. We're very fortunate. The county roads, not so much, but the state roads are excellent. I just drove over them yesterday from Ontario coming back here and was able to exceed the speed limit almost the whole way without... the trouble with it is, when you go to people and say, by the way, we're going to need a lot more money from you, or more money from you, or the same amount, but... buying that new car isn't going to save you all that money that you thought. They don't want to hear. So what is the means of taking advantage, for example, right now of this incredibly low interest rate environment, the lowest rates in the history of the universe, yet we don't seem to be taking advantage of it because we can't convince people that the need is really there and that we should take advantage of it. So what's your advice to us about controlling the message and manage the message and budgeting appropriately to get out the message? What's your advice?
I'm not sure. This is explaining the vision, obviously, is what you're talking about. I do think we are lucky to have a transportation system where the management does a really good job of preserving and maintaining what we have and has put a priority on that. So it's good to know that you can drive above the speed limit. I don't have that experience.
But just because I'm in the legislature.
I do think, I don't think the answer is to create you know, unnecessary potholes. Mm. But I do think it you know, what you want is, I think people like to invest in things that are working well. I honestly believe that. But at the same time, I do think if you look at the county roads, the city roads, and some of the state highways, there are problems that can be identified and probably in any of your districts. And there's certainly opportunities to build new infrastructure that I think would benefit lots of the state, including the bridge crossing. And so I just think we need to be honest and open with Oregonians about what the needs are, both for maintenance and preservation, as well as for new projects, and be very clear what those projects are and how they fit with Oregon values, and then sell that vision and then a financing plan to support it. It's pretty basics on communications, but and if we're not doing a good enough job, we need to help, you know, figure out how to do that.
I actually go back to the comments I made earlier about leadership. I think it is a vision thing. I mean, I think people don't think much about the growth of the state over the next 30, 40 years, and the fact that things might be working well enough for them right now is not an answer to what's going to be necessary for their children and grandchildren. And I mean, I don't think anybody probably thought when Interstate 80 North, which we now know as 84, was built, that there was a requirement for a four-lane freeway from Pendleton to Portland to handle the traffic on the Columbia River Highway. There wasn't. But the people that said that it needed to be done, whether it was at the federal or the state level, said, it, you know, this is for the future. This is what we're doing because this allows us to grow. This is, allows us to serve the needs of our state over the next decades, not over the next 6 months. And we have created a society, and I'm way off my soapbox here, but that is very short-term in thinking. I mean, almost every aspect of our life is a short-term problem. And we've just got to get back on a longer-term vision about what we're trying to do and how we're going to get there. We're not creating enough jobs for the people of this state. We're not giving opportunities for people to do the things that we really would like to see them do. That's why we're working on the educational system. I mean, it's sad that the big investments by some of our more successful companies end up bringing in people from out of state to fill the jobs because we don't create them out of the educational system. You guys all know that. So it does get back to this vision thing. It does say, and it has a component to it, which I think is very resonant with the attitude of the public at the moment, which is it's based, a lot of the financing will be based on user fees, not taxes. And so consequently, you're saying we're doing this because we think there's a lot of people that will be in a position where this is important enough to them to pay a user fee in order to use the facility. And that has a certain resonance to it that perhaps it doesn't for people in Eastern Oregon to talk about the bridge. So I think it's possible. I wouldn't for a minute say it's easy.
Can I build on that for a second and ask a different question? To what extent do you think it makes a difference? I mean, clearly the folks in Representative Bent's district benefit from the bridge. At least I think so. The question is how that becomes clear. And a lot of the costs of transportation are sort of embedded in the prices we pay for products and services,
right,
but we don't think about them. Is there any evidence to suggest that making that more explicit in some way makes a difference to people?
Yeah, the trouble is businesses are shy about that. You know, I mean, I'm a product of wheat and cattle ranchers in Eastern Oregon, and my brother-in-law ships an awful lot of stuff down the Columbia River. The idea that he wants to be a poster child for that is probably not going to work too well, because all it does is make you a target.
Obviously asking, thinking aloud, but that perhaps part of the message question. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I did have a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The just so my folks are understood, clearly, I went to any number of Chamber of Commerce meetings across Eastern Oregon and had almost total support for the bridge.
That's great, and I think that's really good thing.
And they all get it. Eastern Oregon wasn't the issue, and isn't. The challenge, believe it or not, I think, is demographics. And we heard just a few days ago during the revenue forecast, that if you look at rural areas, the demographic model is like this.
Yeah.
And if you have mostly older people in an area that are looking to retire as opposed to build business, they're not going to be wildly enthusiastic about taking on a lot of debt for 40, 50 years in the future, even though they should be. The middle that seem to be rare in our state are becoming more rare, that I view as the biggest challenge for us. And those are the kind of people that showed up at my Chamber of Commerce meetings and said, yes, invest in the future because we think there is one for this state. And so I'm all in favor of the vision thing. What I'm really getting at is I see a real lack of appropriate financing of getting the message out, because the methods we use here are antiquated and
ineffective,
right, exactly. That's how I would view them.
No, I think that's a good point. I also think it's an illustration of why the public-private partnership financing model actually has some benefits to that kind of a demographic, because you're not putting bonds out that are taxpayer-funded over the course of time. You're putting out on the basis of a combination of things, including user fees, that support that financing. So, but I agree. I mean, I think you're right. The communication, I look the way my kids communicate, and I missed that chapter.
So far, message. It's not too late. Representative Parrish?
Thanks. So in December, we all joined you, or most of us joined you, and you gave us little business cards, and the little business cards had three things on them. Build a bridge, fix PERS, fund education. I don't remember what order they're in, but I'm going to assume that they're somewhere.
Invest in education wisely.
Whatever it was.
Nice.
There was something about money and education. And the question, and depending on...
They showed that on the slide earlier.
And I missed it. And I missed it. Yes, I'm sorry. I had constituents working on a different issue. But my question is, so you gave us the little cards. You had a slide that I missed. And depending on your vantage point, my vantage point is I think the outcomes of that is marginal this session at best, given, you know, kind of what's going on with the bridge and what's going on in some of the other conversations. What do you all tell us next December? I mean, have you started to think about what does that next card look like for us, or slide look like for us in terms of where we need to continue to go? Because I just don't feel like we got where we could have gone. Well, it's not over yet, but I just feel like, you know, if we don't get to where we need to be, what does that look like?
Well, first of all, let's don't give up on these three. I think big progress can be made on PERS. I know that's a conversation ongoing. The bridge, you did your piece. We're working with Washington. Do we need to finish the bridge? And the investments you're going to make in education, I hope, including a lot of the redesign and the proposals that are in front of you, are amazing. They're monumental. So I would not suggest that this session can't be a tremendous success. You still have, as we all know, 90% of the work is done in the last
few weeks. Yes.
And so you don't. This is could be an epic session for this legislature.
The lady singing the aria is still warming up.
Yeah. So do not give up. And as far as next round, we will engage with all of you and the business leaders that we work with to come up with an agenda that we hope will be equally exciting and productive. But I don't know, John.
Well, no, I think that's a fair statement. We've thought about a lot of things, but we don't have our mantra for next December yet. And I would hate to think that we did, because it would mean that we haven't taken into account what's happened or will happen here. And because basically, you know, we're still assessing some of the effects of changes that this legislature has made that are just not focused on those three things, but on other things as well. And I can guarantee to you, though, that they will have to do with creating a better economy and more job opportunities in one form or another.
Representative Cameron?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. It's been really good to have this discussion. I have a suggestion for next time. DMV after hours should be one of your objectives.
Happy hour at the DMV.
Yeah.
Open on the after hours to serve our citizens.
Yes. Happy hour at DMV.
Yeah. I'll discount on your license and become.
I like that. The cafe at DMV.
It's quite enough to end. I don't know if anybody can follow that. Are there any other questions? We appreciate you very much being here today, and I'm happy that we will be in touch in one form or another. I for one, am interested in the Transportation Utility Commission. I don't know what everyone else is, but we'll have conversations about that. Thanks, and look forward to having you back next time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks for having us.
We'll close the informational meeting on innovation in transportation infrastructure financing. But before we leave, I know that it was a riveting hearing on county road funding that I missed out a couple of weeks ago. That went on long enough, I think, Mr. Vice Chair, that we prevented Representative Davis from giving us a report on his travels to the National Conference and State Legislatures and what he learned around transportation. So, Representative Davis, I hope it's nothing personal.
They're
all leaving.
I didn't sit close enough to you or what?
That's great. I didn't know the sound of my name got such a reaction yet.
We can also, if you prefer, do it at the beginning of our next meeting, too. That's perfect.
I skipped it once. It's up at the pleasure of the chair. It's going to take about 5 minutes. It actually goes quite well with this discussion.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Kathy, could you pull up the my notes from, I think it's May 9th on the screen, in the meeting materials? So a couple takeaways from the NCSL transportation meeting were public-private partnerships, figuring out better ways to fund our infrastructure and innovative ways to spend existing money that we have. Those were three of the takeaways. And it went very, very well with the discussion that we just had. We actually had a long hearing already on public-private partnerships that some of us at the time probably didn't realize it was about public-private partnerships. That was the Partnerships BC. And talking
West
with
Infrastructure Exchange.
Yeah, and the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. People at NCSL are very excited about Partnerships BC, about the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange, because the point of it is it doesn't necessarily create money. It creates a better way to use existing revenues in a more efficient manner that involves less public risk is the idea. And Mr. Woody's in the room. He can talk about a lot of these things up the wazoo because he knows them quite well. But it made a lot of sense when the presenter from the National Council on Public-Private Partnerships showed a, I think it was May 9th. Is it coming up, Kathy? May 6th, excuse me. I'm sorry. 5-6 hearing in the meeting materials. Showing the differences in contracting methods that governments can enter into and the fact that public-private partnerships is not necessarily privatization. It's shifting risk to the private sector in return for a more innovative way to use existing money and finance projects faster. Basically, it's leveraging the benefits of the private sector with less public risk with the benefits of the public sector. So if you go to page 2...
You might want to go down there and control it yourself for a few days, perhaps.
Well, this is more fun to watch Kathy.
Sorry, Kathy.
Keep her on her toes.
She's a sport.
Thank you. And down a little bit more. There we go. Perfect. So the idea, the advantages of public-private partnerships, Mr. Carter was talking about complete government procurement. You'll see that on the very left side. That has the absolute most risk for the public sector, and it's why we rarely do that anymore. Many governments, including our local governments, including our state governments, use design build and design bid build methods right now. That has shifted some private some public risk onto the public sector. You have a more definite time frame for when projects are completed, and they're generally completed on time much better. The two methods of contracting a public-private partnerships that we haven't really explored are P3 with availability payments and full P3 with traffic risk. This is for infrastructure. The difficulty is, and this comes back to Representative Reed's question of, could you give some examples of how to do this? What clicked in my mind is the statement, if you've seen one public-private partnership, you've seen one public-private partnership. It's not a square peg that you just put on top of every single project. It is a method of setting an outcome, putting the private sector to work and the public sector to work on the most efficient way with existing money to get the project done. That was what finally made sense to me, and that's how Partnerships BC is doing it. If you remember their discussion, it wasn't about how do you create money from nothing. That's right. How do we use existing revenue streams to build projects better, faster, and more efficiently? If you go to the next page, Kathy, seven keys to successful PPPs. I think we basically heard all of these today. You've got to have a public sector champion. In most instances, this is going to be the executive branch, the governor, or our legislative leaders really saying, we want to do this, we want to do this well. Second is having a statutory environment in which it's possible. Oregon does, because of some work that our senators and representatives did a number of years ago. We've got the Office of Innovative Partnerships and the statutory framework where we can in Oregon do public-private partnerships. We just really don't do them right now. A business plan. You've got to have public sector organized to do it, a clearly defined revenue stream, and finally, stakeholder support. Just some examples. This is from Virginia. Just if you go to the next page, Kathy, takeaway number, I'm supposed to say number three, there are no magic bullets. Virginia just passed a new transportation funding package headed by a Republican governor, supported by leaders of both parties. The senator from Virginia who spoke on their package said, what did they do first before going to the voters for more revenue? What did they do? First is they tried public-private partnerships, and they utilized them well. He contended that they'd saved almost $3 billion in 2012 alone through using public-private partnerships. They've used tolls. Department of Transportation reform, I think that's something you heard our panelists talk about today, which is reforming the processes by which we create projects and get them done to make that more efficient. And use of bonds and debt, especially some cheap government debt and what Representative Benz talked about. They had already done those three things. I don't know if Oregon has done them sufficiently yet. And having done those things, they went back for a transportation funding package that replaced cents per gallon at the pump with a 3.5% tax on gasoline, a 6% tax on diesel, a $64 registration fee for alternative fuel vehicles, increasing the titling charges, and increasing sales and use taxes. So that's one way that they got about the transportation funding package. Still hotly contested, as you can imagine, anything that raised revenue would be. And what funding options are used in other states? Well, if it can be taxed or feed, it has been taxed or feed. We heard about fuel taxes, sales on gas taxes, car sales taxes, car rental taxes, vehicle weight fees, traffic camera fees, tolls, general fund, interest income, lottery, right-of-way, logo signing, service concession, impact fees, and almost any other sort of fee you can imagine. So lots of different things have been tried in different states. I came away with the sense that Oregon is ahead in some areas and behind in others. Certainly public-private partnerships is an area that we could have more leadership and get more done from a couple different areas of our state. And I think it would encourage investment and save money. So that's the quick rundown.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Davis?
Great, thank you. When is your next NCSL meeting, this committee?
There's going to be transportation forum and the general meeting in August, and then December after that. Yep.
I don't know when the dates are for our interim committee meetings, but hopefully you'll be able to report back on how things continue to progress there.
Absolutely.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the time.
You bet. If there aren't any other comments from the committee, I'll just remind you on Wednesday we will be hearing Senate bills. The public hearings and work sessions are posted on OLIS, so please come prepared to work those bills. Our deadline for posting is in about 30 minutes. We've posted what we're going to post. We're going to work just about all the bills that came to us from the Senate. Unfortunately, from my perspective, we didn't get a lot from the Senate, so we have plenty of capacity to deal with what we did get. Anything else for the committee? Thank you. See you Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good meeting.
Yeah, that's so too. Thanks.